From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the United States transitions to a new presidency, attempting to put 4 years of Donald Trump behind us, Mr. Joe Biden has a flurry of initial actions planned, including rejoining the Paris Accords and putting an end to the Keystone XL pipeline project. But according to my next guest, climate action needs to be rooted in local actions and policy, and most importantly, in justice. Shalanda Baker is a professor at the Northeastern School of Law. Before joining Northeastern's faculty, she spent 3 years as an associate professor of law at the William S. Richardson School of Law at the University of Hawaii, where she was the founding director of the Energy Justice Program. In 2016, she won a Fulbright Award and spent a year in Mexico exploring energy reform, climate change, and indigenous rights. She now joins me to discuss her new book, Revolutionary Power, an activist's guide to the energy transition. Welcome to the program, Shalanda.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
So as we are transitioning to a Biden presidency, on the broad federal level, do you see hope on the horizon, especially as compared to the 4 years of Trump when we are talking about climate change and even climate justice?
Sonali, there is no comparison. I mean, we're talking about night and day. So we think about the Trump administration, it was very much a systematic dismantling of environmental protections for communities of color, most notably, you know, waiving requirements for polluters right in the middle of the pandemic, even when we were beginning to learn more about how exposure to air pollution made it more likely that you were going to suffer, bleak consequences as a result of COVID-19. So the Trump administration has taken a very cynical approach to environmental protection and very much driven by profit and driven by sort of, you know, again, rollbacks. The New York Times itself did an analysis and found over 100 different regulatory rollbacks in that administration. And so as we turn the page to the Biden administration, you know, we're already seeing with some of his top picks a very different approach, starting with Michael Regan, the head of the EPA, a Black policymaker from North Carolina, which I should say is where the environmental justice movement really took off, in Warren County. And so, you know, that signals his appointment, and again, it needs to be Senate confirmed, his appointment really signals a shift in terms of how we're thinking about environmental issues. I think similarly, setting up a climate czar, if you will, in Gina McCarthy, she will be right at the White House driving climate policy. That signals a real attention to climate change as an issue. And Gina obviously comes out of the EPA. She's now going to be the outgoing president of, or president and CEO of the Natural Resources Defense Council. So she really has the technical chops to drive climate policy. She was one of the architects of the Clean Power Plan under the Obama administration. And as her deputy, she has Ali Zaidi, who comes out of New York. New York is a leading state in terms of climate policy. Just last summer, Governor Cuomo signed into law the Community Leadership and Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which really makes a commitment to frontline environmental justice communities. And so I think with this team that also includes John Kerry as an external international climate envoy, we're really set up for success. And I would be remiss without mentioning the Council on Environmental Quality, which is where a lot of the environmental justice work in the administration happens. And we have Brenda Mallory, who is coming from the Southern Environmental Law Center, really driving and leading a lot of initiatives there. And she's a veteran to government work. And one of her key deputies there will be Cecilia Martinez, who I think of as the mother of the environmental justice movement. So If that long answer didn't give you any clue, I'll just put a fine point on it. And that is, you know, we're headed in a vastly different direction with this new administration.
You write in your book that your main objective, quote, is to model an approach of justice first in pursuit of averting catastrophic climate change rather than one of climate first, justice later. What do you mean by that? What have you been worried about in seeing the approach to tackling climate change?
Yeah. So, Sonali, I'll answer that question by giving an example and an anecdote from my own background and my own life story. So I left practice as a corporate lawyer way back in 2009 and found myself in 2010 in January living in Oaxaca, Mexico, which is very much ground zero for Mexico's energy transition. And when I say energy transition, I'm talking about the transition away from fossil fuels to clean energy. And so when I got to Oaxaca, I actually met indigenous peoples who were fighting against mega wind, massive wind development. And as I dug into that issue, I realized that they were being dispossessed, displaced, divided, not to use too many D words, but you know, all of the bad things that we connect to fossil fuel and fossil fuel development were happening in Oaxaca. And Oaxaca, again, is a remarkable place for any of your viewers out there. I recommend it. But it's also home to no fewer than 14 distinct indigenous groups. It's one of the poorest places in Mexico. And the place where all of this wind energy development was taking place is called the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. And it's a small stretch of land that happens to be one of the windiest places on Earth. And so starting from my time in 2010 to now, we've seen an exponential growth of wind energy development there, and very much a grassroots indigenous movement against that development because they're simply not benefiting from it. And now Oaxaca has the proud distinction of being a place with one of the highest, if not the highest, concentration of onshore wind energy in the world. And again, that type of dense development, extractive development, that is not benefiting them at all. And so I had the opportunity, as you mentioned in lead up and in my bio, that to go down to Mexico in 2016 to serve as a Fulbright scholar. And, you know, I was there to really look at and explore and do research connected to the transition, Mexico's transition. They just opened up their markets to private investments for the first time in over 100 years. And, you know, I had the opportunity to sit down with a policymaker who was at the equivalent of the Department of Energy, but in Mexico. And I said, what are we going to do? You know, how are you going to address these social and environmental issues related to this transition? And you're running over the rights of indigenous peoples in this development. And he said, Shalanda, climate change. We have to do this because climate change is an emergency. And so again, this is a mentality of let's avert climate change first and then worry about issues of equity. But what is lost in that analysis is the understanding that the very people that you're sort of running over in your race to avert catastrophic climate change are the ones who are on the front lines who will receive the very worst impacts of the climate emergency. And so I argue in the book that we should be centering those communities and centering their concerns in this transition.
So are you worried that the same structures and the same institutions that have fomented climate change are going to be handed the reins of getting us out of this crisis and therefore leave out the issue of justice and human rights? I mean, we see even fossil fuel companies and financial institutions, you know, sort of come late to the party and decided that they are now going to work toward addressing climate change, of course, in the hopes of making money from it. But that may be a massive, that may, you know, be fraught with pitfalls.
It is absolutely fraught with pitfalls. And I think we need to be really careful about who we empower in this transition. And I think we need to interrogate the structures that we have come to accept as a natural part of the fabric. And by structures, I mean our approaches to energy policy, our approaches to electricity rate making, as well as our approaches to, you know, the types of actors that we're relying on to shepherd us, you know, out of this dark place with, you know, the heavy reliance on fossil fuels to clean energy. And I, you know, very skeptically view, you know, the fossil fuel industry as it attempts to sort of change hats, you know, in this new moment. So I think you're absolutely right to voice some skepticism on your end, and also cynicism even with respect to the types of actors that we're relying on. And so I would argue that, again, all of it is on the table. We know that we have a legal system that is rife with inequality. We know that there's so much structural inequality all around us. And I would connect the struggle for, you know, racial justice within the criminal justice system to the struggle for racial justice within the energy system. You know, no part of our society has been spared by structural inequality. So it follows that our electricity system and that our energy system are similarly burdened by racial injustice.
Tell me about your time in Port Arthur, Texas, which you write about in your book, and how that is in many ways an example of the environmental racism we have seen, and can offer a guide to how climate change needs to focus on justice.
Right. So Port Arthur, Texas is the birthplace of the modern fossil fuel industry, as well as its current spine and epicenter. It's also a low-income Black and Latinx community, and it is a part of what is broadly referred to as the Golden Triangle, which is to say that on a satellite image, you see lights lighting up this particular part of the Texas-Louisiana border area. And that area is lit up because of all the petrochemical and fossil fuel facilities that are concentrated in this particular place. It's also been called Cancer Alley, because in many ways it is what we would call in the environmental justice community a sacrifice zone. So that place has been sacrificed in order to provide cheap energy to the rest of us in this country. It also happens to be the place where my father grew up. And my father worked in the electricity sector for the local utility. My grandfather worked for, I think, Chevron. My uncles also worked for the oil industry. And so it is both the benefactor as well as the thing that has made life for people in that area so difficult from an environmental standpoint. We have cancer rates that are higher there. We have all sorts of other maladies that are high due to their status as an environmental justice community. And so I had the opportunity to spend a little bit of time there when I was around 8 years old. And I took it, my parents were split. So I had a chance to go down with my sister, and we spent a summer there. And I really got to know that place. I fell in love with it. It was, you know, for me, such a foreign land. I grew up in Austin, which is very urban, and Port Arthur is semi-rural in some ways, and it's on the bayou, and there's a fishing culture, so people are crabbing and fishing and eating fried fish for dinner, and the accents are different. I mean, I couldn't understand anything going on half the time, but I fell in love with it, and as I pulled back many, many years later, I mean, I'm talking about in the last couple years, and really began to dive into my work on energy justice and environmental justice, I realized that Port Arthur is so crucial to our nation's energy story. And I'll give you one stark example that was very much my entry point into Port Arthur as a study. Back in 2017, I was, you know, fastidiously following all of the news and developments around Hurricane Harvey. And, you know, late one night, I was scrolling through the New York Times, and there was a Facebook Live video posted, and a young man was on the video saying, "Help us, please help us. We are in knee deep water. We need help. We need help." And this was a young man from Port Arthur. And that young man happened to be my half brother. So that was the moment where it hit me that I have a stake in this transition. And I have commitments based on where I come from to tell these stories.
You write that utilities reform is the linchpin to transforming the energy system. And in addition to Mexico, in addition to Port Arthur, Hawaii and the state of Hawaii is a very important model for climate justice, but also, you know, showcase how that whole struggle unfolded. Tell me about what Hawaii can teach us, you know, for those who were lucky enough to have traveled there. One thing jumps out at people, which is that rooftop solar is almost everywhere on mm-hmm. any of the islands. Many of the islands have, homes that are just dotted with solar on their rooftops, which could be the case in many more states around the nation, but isn't. Why?
Right. So, Sonali, I love that you read the book and found it so compelling. It's like, yes, that was the goal, to really make, you know, these technical energy topics come alive, and for the sakes of our transition to really become tangible to the reader. And so I had the privilege and honor to go to Hawaii in 2014, and I joined the faculty at the University of Hawaii School of Law. And I got there at a really exciting time. So as you say, Sonali, rooftop solar was everywhere. And at that time, there was about, I think there were about 17% of all of residents there had rooftop solar. So that's almost 1 in 5. It's extraordinary. It was the highest rate of solar adoption in the country at that time. And so at the same time, the utility was pushing up against that and saying, whoa, 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 this is too much distributed energy generation, because that rooftop solar was taking away from their ability to, their bottom line, essentially. You know, when you generate solar on your rooftop, you're getting a discount. You're selling your electricity back to the grid, as opposed to having to pay the provider for your electricity. And this was cutting into the utility's profits. And so they're making a range of arguments, including that the grid was too unstable to allow for so much electricity going back into the grid. The grid was designed to push it out to homes. They were making the argument that rooftop solar hurt poor people, because it was leaving them with the cost of maintaining
and,
the grid.
And this is an argument you hear over and over and over again in so many different arenas. You know, here in California, where I am based, you hear any arguments usually pushed by corporate lobbyists that anything that is there to hurt them or their bottom line really is an insult to poor people and working people and people of color.
Well, here's what I would say in response in terms of the insults, right? Rooftop solar isn't the insult. The insult is placing fossil fuel generation in communities of color. Mm. The insult is the disproportionate burden that homes, low to moderate income homes, are paying for electricity. Our electricity rate design is regressive. That means the poorest people are paying more of their overall income to just keep the lights on. That's an insult. That's the issue that utilities should be tackling, rather than trying to end rooftop solar, which actually lowers emissions, if we think about it over a longer time horizon, in the very communities they say they care about. That's my response to that. So it's a very sort of cynical, disingenuous approach. And so all of that was kind of happening in Hawaii. It was the preview to what we are seeing around the country. And for me, it was just like a kid in the candy store. What I realized, going back to your original question, is that utilities were at the heart of all of these debates. And they were at the heart of all of those debates because of their business model. They're incentivized to sell electricity. They're incentivized to build infrastructure, to build stuff. And the regulator in the state, and I'm making it sound like a soap opera because it really felt like a soap opera then. Mm-hmm. The regulator in the state, the Public Utilities Commission, said, utility, you are slow walking our clean energy transition. You must innovate, or you're going to be regulated out of existence. So either you can play a role in this transition, or you need to step aside, because climate change is real. And, you know, distributed energy is something that we need for resilience and for a whole host of reasons. And so I got to witness that. And that's why utility justice and utility reform have become such a central part, I think, of my analysis, regarding our energy transition and how to do that in a way that is just.
And of course, on the mainland here in the United States, you see many people who might love to have solar on their rooftops if they're lucky enough to be homeowners, or simply be able to draw their energy from solar and not have to live near, say, a fracking well, but simply don't have the money to make that happen because they're busy putting food on their table. So how can the Hawaii model be expanded to local communities, to utilities across the country? Because it shouldn't be that cost prohibits people from being able to have rooftop solar.
You're absolutely right, Sonali. So there are three key ways people can get access to solar. They've got the savings and they can buy the solar panels outright. Okay. We know who's privileged enough to do that. And we know kind of how wealth disparities have played out in this country. So that's not a lot of Black and Brown and Indigenous people. The second way is, you can go to the bank and get a loan to have them buy the solar panels and you pay off that loan.
Or there are companies that just lease it to you, which is what I did for my
home. That's the third way. So the third way is the leasing model. And I think all of those ways or of accessing solar are kind of put on top of a society that is structurally unequal. And so, the folks who are able to benefit from those particular models are not low to moderate income people, right, due to credit score and due to, even access to banks, which we know redlining has made difficult in certain communities.
And all of them involve either going into debt or having, large nest egg to invest into it.
Exactly. And so what I would say is that everyone pays their electricity bill, right? And studies have shown that this is one of the first bills that people pay, even when they're at the margins. We should use the electricity bill as a vehicle, as a mechanism to allow for on-bill financing of solar, which would mean, the utility is essentially carrying that risk. And we could back up that risk. Now I'm getting back into my corporate law kind of corporate finance days, but we could sort of that provide a backstop to that risk with things like green banks, which are, sometimes formed by a legislature, sometimes formed by other capital investments. But, there are ways to manage that risk. But we know that electricity and energy are fundamental human rights. And so we have to figure out a way to get broader access to that. And I should say that the disparity in solar access in communities of color isn't just for low to moderate income folks. It exists in middle income and higher income communities, and there's a racial component to this. I suspect that it's due in part to the largely white solar industry. There are reports and studies showing that the solar industry itself is not diverse. So we've got to diversify the solar industry. We've got to create not just jobs for installers, which is noble, and hopefully those are union jobs, but we need to create businesses that are owned by people of color, so that they're seeding solar in their own communities.
So finally, there's so much more to talk about, but we're sort of limited by time, and I can certainly encourage people to read your book and start to spread these ideas. When we think about the transition that needs to happen, do you worry that there's going to be far too much opposition to delivering what needs to be delivered as fast as possible without worrying about who it's impacting? And at the same time, we do have a pretty vibrant grassroots Black and Brown and Indigenous-led movement now, more so than we did 10 years ago, demanding climate justice. We have the call for a Green New Deal, which has, of course, been rejected as too radical. But, in terms of which path you think the United States will choose, especially under a President Joe Biden, what are your hopes or fears?
I have only hope. We're not going back. We are not going back. And, the president has, Joe Biden has made a commitment to move 40% of all climate investments to frontline environmental justice communities. And I take him at his word to do that. And I think the folks who he has filled his administration with are committed to those goals and understand what's at stake in this transition. And so, we're not going back in the same way we're not going back to accepting police violence against Black bodies and Brown bodies. We're not going back to a world where people of color are on the wrong end of this transition. We can only move forward. And I have faith that it'll either happen in government or people on the ground will insist that it happens. So we're not going back.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Shalonda, good luck with the book.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. My guest has been Shalonda Baker, professor at the Northeastern School of Law. Before joining Northeastern's faculty, she spent 3 years as an associate professor of law at the William S. Richardson School of Law at the University of Hawaii, where she was a founding director of the Energy Justice Program. In 2016, she won a Fulbright Award and spent a year in Mexico exploring energy reform, climate change, and indigenous rights. We've been talking about her new book, Revolutionary Power, An Activist's Guide to the Energy Transition. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at Rising Up with Sonali. Sonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.